This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, journalist Charles Sennett, just spent a month in Iraq, a month in which security deteriorated. Among the stories he covered were the downing of a U.S. Chinook helicopter, the rocket attack against the Al-Rashid Hotel, where Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz was staying, and a synchronized attack by suicide bombers that struck the Red Cross headquarters and three police stations. It was Sennett's first trip to Iraq since covering the war. We invited him to talk with us about what he observed there. Now he's back home in London, where he works as the Boston Globe's London bureau chief. A little later, we'll talk about President Bush's visit. This morning, I asked Sennett if he was expecting that so much of his time in Iraq would be devoted to covering attacks by the insurgents.
Well, I think things shifted while I was there. When I first arrived, there was some discussion, among the media about whether or not we were being unfair to the U.S.-led occupation if we only kept writing the bad news. So there was almost a certain amount of pressure out of Washington on the media to write the good news. And I think something happened in mid-October that you could feel this shift in the air. It really became much more ominous. The opposition there, the insurgents, became much more menacing. They really stepped up their attacks. And it, of course, began with this attack on the Al-Rashid Hotel, where Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz was staying at the time. And this was a pretty well-orchestrated, sophisticated attack. It involved a multiple rocket launcher, if everyone remembers that. And suddenly, all of these missiles began bombarding the Al-Rashid Hotel, which is kind of the heart of American power. And it killed a soldier on the 12th floor, just a few yards below the room where Wolfowitz was staying on the 13th floor. So there was this sudden sense of they are going to try to really strike at American power in Baghdad. And I think from that point on, that became what the story was about. And I really found myself running on the escalation in attacks and the deteriorating security situation.
You had mentioned that there had been pressure from the Bush administration on the press to put a more positive interpretation on the story of the U.S. presence there. Is that pressure you felt directly at any point?
I don't think you feel it directly, but I think you factor it in. You wonder, you know, are we being fair here? It takes you a while to get your feet on the ground to understand the story, and you kind of talk to your colleagues who've been there. And what I kept hearing is everyone saying, it's really bad here. And that so contravened the message coming out of Washington that you had to kind of walk your editors through understanding just what it felt like on the ground, just how dangerous the central part of the country, the so-called Sunni Triangle in Iraq, just how dangerous that was and how much the security situation was deteriorating and how rapidly it was deteriorating.
Why don't you walk us through that?
Well, I mean, one of the scenes that I think is the most memorable for me was having lunch in the palace that Saddam built during his reign that is now the headquarters for the U.S.-led occupation. It's where Bremer lives on the grounds there. It's where many of those chief administrators in the occupation live. And I was invited into the palace for a lunch. And this was really unbelievable for me to see as a reporter who'd covered Iraq. You used to look at this palace from a distance and imagine Saddam in there. And for me, anyway, it was the first time coming into this very opulent palace where I was invited by a very senior official in the Coalition Provisional Authority, the CPA, the head of the occupation. And we sat down in this beautiful dining room with crystal chandeliers and marble and marble mosaics tiled all over the walls, telling the history and grandeur of Iraq, and a lot of kind of pictures of Scud missiles, for example, on the wall. But it's tremendously opulent, and it's so Ba'athist, and you're right in the heart of the Saddam era of extravagance. And here, of course, is the American-led coalition, and we kind of all lined up for food with American soldiers in fatigues and American contractors from the Halliburton subsidiary KBR and the guys from Bechtel, these two big American companies with huge contracts there. And everyone seems to be wearing cowboy boots and baseball hats. And you really feel the presence of the American empire here in Iraq. And during this lunch in this very nice air-conditioned palace, the official from the CPA kept telling me how great this occupation was going. And this, of course, was the message coming from Paul Bremer, who's the head of the occupation in Iraq. And the message was so on for them. They kept hammering away at the schools they're building, at the amount of money that they're pumping into the local economy, and how they feel the people are really receiving this warmly. And of course, while I'm talking to him, I'm trying to square that with what I felt on the street, which is completely different and a much darker picture. And literally, I was being text messaged during the lunch about the downing of a Chinook helicopter near Fallujah. And every time I checked my text message, the death toll went up. At first, it was several dead, then it was 10 dead, and then it was 15 dead, and then it was more than 15 American soldiers killed in the downing of the Chinook. And finally, I had to say to this senior official, I have to go. And when I left the palace and went to this small village outside of Fallujah to see the wreckage of the downed Chinook and all of the villagers cheering for this and really supporting it, you really began to experience in a very physical, tangible way this huge gap between the U.S.-led occupation and the administrators who carry it out, what they're saying, and what was happening on the ground.
Well, in talking about that contrast between the message that you're getting from the provisional authority and from the Bush administration and the reality that you felt you were witnessing in Baghdad, after the Al-Rashid Hotel in which Wolfowitz was staying was under missile attack, he held a press conference in which he said, the mission is really going well. What was it like to be at that press conference hearing him stating, describing how well the mission was going after the hotel he was in was under attack?
That was a very hastily called press conference that I was not invited to because it was really only for those reporters who were traveling with him. It was really only the defense correspondents who get to go to those nice, cozy little briefings. Those of us in the field don't always get the word that they're happening, which always makes me very interested because we never get to ask the questions we want to ask. But that was, called it really at the last second just to show that he was alive, I think. And watching that press conference, it was very obvious that Wolfowitz was visibly very shaken. And, here was the architect of the war in Iraq, someone who had been putting together the policies that would lead to a war in Iraq even before 9/11 happened. And then to see this war come that close to him personally, I thought was a very important moment in understanding U.S. policy in Iraq. And to hear him defending the U.S.-led occupation, even when it's coming straight at him personally, I think really crystallized, as I say, this gap that was there between what Washington had been saying and what was happening on the ground. I think that Washington recently has recognized that gap, and I think they're now really trying to react to the situation in the reality of what it is rather than what they had hoped it would be.
What hotel did you stay in, and how safe did you feel there?
Well, we were staying in the Alhambra Hotel, which is not too far from the Al-Rashid Hotel. You can see the Al-Rashid from my room, which was on the sixth floor of the Alhambra Hotel. The Alhambra Hotel was uniquely a precarious spot, frankly, to be, because we had very specific warnings that members of the coalition found to be credible that the hotel was going to be attacked. And so a lot of us, including myself, ended up fleeing this hotel and seeking shelter elsewhere until the security situation could be really assessed, until we could actually have more blast walls, as they're called, put in to protect the hotel from a car bomb, to have these private security forces that a lot of media organizations are hiring really reassess security there, rethink how they're going to patrol the perimeter. And we had to all kind of factor in our own heads whether or not we felt comfortable going back there. So a lot of us are still tossing about how we're going to work there. Should we be in hotels? Is there safety in numbers? Should you get with some kind of protective force behind blast walls? Or should we be in houses, in neighborhoods with a much lower profile, on our own, you know, maybe with a bodyguard, as many people in Iraq, not just Westerners, have bodyguards, and try to operate that way. But I think all of it, when you get out of there and you step back for a minute, raises some pretty interesting questions just about kind of how the Fortress America idea is also beginning to invade our work as journalists. That sense that we were somehow immune to covering these conflicts has been vanishing for quite a while, but I think in Iraq right now you really feel so vulnerable as an American journalist, as really any Western journalist. And all of that was really crystallized in our hotel, in particular, the Alhambra.
So did you stay at the homes of Iraqis when you left the hotel?
I did. I stayed several nights with a translator friend of the Al-Jaburi tribe and was able to have iftar with him, or to celebrate the breaking of the fast during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, all of which is, you know, part of being there and part of trying to understand the story. And that was very worthwhile. I also had a generous invitation from ABC News to stay with them for a while. And they had a much lower profile set of buildings that they had set up their headquarters in. So colleagues look out for each other. There's a pretty good spirit of working together. And that's what I did. And then I eventually did go back to the Alhambra, because I felt like it was safer. I don't know. It was an assessment that you had to make, and I felt okay being there. But a lot of journalists I know did leave that hotel and are not returning.
The Bush administration is trying to speed up the movement toward Iraqi sovereignty. The Bush administration is now saying that it might restore Iraqi independence as early as next June. How is that changing the plans for how much of the democratic process will be in place at the time Iraq assumes sovereignty again?
Well, what they're talking about is really accelerating the process pretty dramatically. Originally, the U.S. administration's plan was to take a slow approach, to begin building the institutions that would help them have a transition to a sovereign democratic country, to create a kind of council that could advise the coalition as they went ahead with writing a constitution, conducting a census, and then having an election that would put in place a internationally recognized government of Iraq, and then that would lead to the transition and the handover. I think really during my time there in the last month, we saw, you know, as I say, this incredible deterioration of the security situation, and Washington reacted. On my last day there, they called back Paul Bremer, the head of the U.S.-led occupation, to Washington, and they kind of rewrote the book. And they decided that what they were going to do is actually try to find a way to put a recognized government that could be put in place and have authority over the government, if not sovereignty, immediately, and hopefully get a recognized body in there up front. And now they're talking about doing that by June, and then write the constitution, do the census, and have an election later. I think the recognition was that it's taking too long. There was great frustration in Washington with how slow the governing council, the 25 members who were appointed by Washington, were taking, and just how cumbersome that whole council had become. And so they reacted, I think, pretty quickly, and they've really tried to reorder, reprioritize, and they're really going to try to push ahead with that now. Whether or not this is really going to work, whether or not they're going to make it by June, is going to be something to really watch in the next few months.
Critics of that course are saying it's the Bush administration preparing for the next election, and that democracy is a slow process, and there's the possibility that if the American and British presence pull out on the early side, that we will leave chaos behind us, chaos and anarchy, that will become more of a breeding ground for terrorists, and that democracy will be less likely to take root because of the possibility that there wasn't a firm foundation built for it. That's what the critics are saying.
Right. I mean, I think the opponents see it as an exit strategy, and I think they see it as turning and running from the responsibilities that came with invading that country. And I think critics would say, look, you had a policy which was to unilaterally act to invade Iraq. Yes, you brought a pseudo-coalition along with you, but you defied the United Nations and you went ahead with your invasion of Iraq. And you did so without a solid plan of how you would implement the democracy you hoped would be built there in Iraq. And you've left a real period of chaos and a real vacuum of power and a real mess, frankly, in which a lot of Iraqi civilians are dying and a lot of American and other coalition members, soldiers, are dying. And the critics are saying, now you're talking about this exit strategy and running. And I think that is a very valid criticism, but I think it may be premature. I think we're going to really have to see how they parse this out, how they go at it, and how it coincides, as you point out very accurately, with domestic politics, with George Bush's looming election.
Were you able to, I don't know if the press is allowed into this, but were you able to sit in on any of the governing council's meetings?
Not their meetings, but we were able to go to many press conferences, and I found them really interesting. I went to these a lot, and I often found myself with only a handful of other American reporters. A lot of times it was kind of viewed as a waste of time, I think, by some of the reporters who've been there a while and who had grown frustrated with this incredibly cumbersome body of 25 people from every different aspect of Iraqi life. But I found it kind of fascinating to watch the mix, to hear the conversations, to see them trying to put out this message, and to hear the vying constituencies, essentially, in Iraq, to hear the Shiite message coming from Hakim, and then to hear the message coming from the Communist Party, for example, within Iraq, or then hearing kind of the Reform Monarchy Party putting in its two cents, and just watching this whole soup that is still cooking in Iraq and that's going to have to somehow form a government. And there were moments of realization there that this is going to be very difficult. And there were kind of, I think, exciting moments of recognizing that this really is the stirrings of something new in Iraq. And having been to Iraq a lot before the war and seeing the way the Shiite population was treated, the way the Kurdish population was treated, to know the oppression that was there and to see this opening up to them to take part in a government, albeit one appointed by the coalition, was pretty exciting, actually.
So there are representatives on the governing council who are representing parts of the population that had been very oppressed under Saddam Hussein. Do you think those representatives are acting on those principles of freedom that they have now, or do you think that there's a degree of kind of vengeance or group self-interest that's kind of dominating the direction they're heading in?
I think group self-interest is a real issue in Iraq. I think it's really what drives all of the sides. I still think there is a tribalism in Iraq that we need to understand really well in America if we're going to play any role in helping them build a democracy. And kind of looking at that honestly and clearly and saying that the Shiite majority in Iraq has long been oppressed and really sees this as its moment to gain power, to really exert itself. And they are pushing in that direction very strongly. The Sunni minority, which has always been the group from which Saddam Hussein drew his most loyal support, is hugely concerned, worried, and reacting to this. And the Kurdish minority from the north has different concerns. They see this as a possibility to continue their experiment in a pseudo-sovereign state in the north that they call Kurdistan, and that they want to continue to foster, to build, and to really push forward, because they're very proud of what they accomplished when they were protected in the no-fly zone in the north and built their own little pseudo-sovereign state. So each of these groups have very different agendas, and I think we're going to have to be very clear on who they are, what they want, And Washington's going to have to pay close attention to that if it's really going to make some kind of democracy work. Because after all, if you really just went on a purely democratic basis right now, I think you would see a Shiite in power. And I think there are a lot of people in the Sunni and in the Kurdish populations, and even in the secular, the kind of vast secular majority that would make up Iraq, you'll see concerns about that, because there is a voice that would express concern about the imposition of Sharia or Islamic law. Certainly Sharia will form the basis of Iraq's law, as Sharia forms the basic laws of most of the countries in the Muslim world. But I think people fear an overly puritanical interpretation of that could rise out of this, even democratically rise out of this. And how all of this is going to be balanced is one of the really great questions for the future in Iraq.
What's security like in the streets? Did you have any close calls in the streets?
We had no close calls on the street, although the day when the International Red Cross building was bombed was a uniquely frightening day, in the sense that we were covering one bombing and then we could hear the sequence of the three other bombings that all happened within 45 minutes. So there was a sense of bombings going on all around you. I've covered a lot of bombings, having reported in Israel and in the West Bank and in Gaza. And, you know, we're sadly way too used to covering bombings for those of us who've covered the Middle East. But this one had a uniquely horrifying aspect to it, in that you felt like you were in the middle of it and it was happening around you. And so that was probably the closest call on the street. Frankly, the other real, you know, fear you have on the street is being shot by American soldiers. These are young soldiers who are manning checkpoints, who are in tanks with 50 caliber machine guns, which are very, very powerful, heavy caliber guns. And their fingers are on the trigger, whether they're in the stationary positions at checkpoints or they're in the armored Humvees cruising down the streets of Baghdad through very crowded marketplaces, where you may just be out, you know, changing some money or even shopping or just walking around with translators trying to understand how people feel in the street. And there were, I have to say, many moments when you feel those guns quickly turn in your direction that are very frightening. And sadly, a lot of Iraqi civilians have been killed when soldiers have overreacted at times to the threat around them. So that is another side of the threat that you feel, and that, frankly, a lot of Iraqi citizens feel when they're walking through the streets. And I think it has something to do with the growing alienation that I heard among Iraqis from the U.S. occupying forces.
Are you critical of the U.S. military's approach to dealing with security in post-war Iraq, or do you think it's the situation itself, an impossible situation, that is leading to these close calls?
I think it's a really complicated equation that you really have to look at in different parts. And I think the U.S. military has many different personalities, frankly. It can go from division to division. For example, I was with the 101st Airborne Division in northern Iraq, where they are taking a very sophisticated approach in terms of working with the community, building schools, meeting with the tribal leaders, meeting with the Muslim clerics in the mosques, really reaching out to the community, really doing a lot of creative, dynamic things. And in the north, the 101st Airborne Division is led by a very enlightened general who is a smart guy, who's taking a different approach and who's actually had great success up there. Then you can go to the 82nd Airborne in the areas more closer to Baghdad, in the heart of the Sunni triangle. And there you see a much more confrontational approach. Now, it's true that they also have a much higher number of insurgents to deal with, essentially. So they are, of course, more tense and, of course, more quick to react. But I do think there's also something about the personality that I learned about from being with a lot of the different soldiers. They're aware of this. They know the 101st Airborne Division has a different personality than 82nd. And there's a sense that I learned about, which is, hey, the American military is a place that has different personalities. Some are overreacting and some I would criticize. Some seem to be doing a pretty good job and are really more comfortable in the role of policing. One of the other interesting comparisons was to go down to the south, where the British soldiers are policing in Basra. And there we saw the British soldiers had a very different approach. These are regiments who understand their regimental histories in colonial Britain. They understand that their regiment was in fact there in southern Iraq during World War I. They know the history of the 1920 revolt and the mistakes that the military made in that. And there's a real sense in the British Army of having a history of empire, having a history of occupation, of colonial expeditions or enforcements of occupations. Not all of it really heartwarming stuff. They have good and bad elements to that. Certainly their experience in Northern Ireland was very instructive for them. When they used too many strong arm tactics, it really backfired on them. So the British brought a sophistication to it that I thought was interesting to compare with the American forces.
What about the presence of Iraqi soldiers or police? Do you see much of that presence in the streets?
Increasingly, you do, and the coalition forces are training them as quickly as they can to get them out on the street, and that is a very, very important development that really, from everything we were hearing, can't happen quickly enough. You're beginning to see a kind of perimeter force of Iraqi military and police around different buildings, around even military installations. Now you'll start to see more and more Iraqi soldiers out there. But the United States government, as the leadership of the coalition, decided to go very slowly and really dismantled the Iraqi army. And I heard from a lot of Iraqi people, politicians, soldiers, people who were in the old regime, people who were in the underground that lived abroad that was really opposed to the regime. All these different people would all of them say that they really believed America miscalculated on the Iraqi army, that the Iraqi army has a very proud tradition that would go back many generations, at least 75 years, and that the Iraqi people are proud of their army, and that for America to completely dismantle it was a tactical mistake and a cultural mistake. And I think it's interesting now, as I say, to see Washington trying to react to that, to rethink and to respond.
How much of a responsibility are Iraqi troops and police taking for dealing with insurgents who are operating against the U.S. presence?
There's huge frustration about that among the Iraqi police, that they are not playing an active enough role. We heard this repeatedly from the governing council leadership across the spectrum, and also from those who I interviewed who are police working on different cases. They feel they have a lot to add, that they have a lot of security information, that they keep giving it to the U.S. government or to the U.S. military, and that that information is not acted upon. And they feel that America is making a huge mistake in not relying on them more. America's recognition recently seems to be that, yeah, they're admitting they do need to involve the Iraqi authorities more in going after who these people are, who is this opposition, trying to understand it. And I think you're going to see more and more that Washington is going to try to now listen to that criticism and try to rely more on the Iraqi police and authorities who understand who this enemy is. Who are these loyalists? Who are the foreign fighters who have come in from the country, and to what extent is there an element that is neither loyal to Saddam nor a foreign fighter nor an Islamic militant, but a frustrated ex-soldier who really wants to end the occupation of his country? And I think they're going to have to rely on Iraqis to get a more deeper and more complicated understanding of that. And I think to some extent the Bush administration has recognized that in the last week or so.
We've been hearing a lot about American casualties in Iraq. Did you get a sense of whether there are many Iraqi casualties in Iraq now?
Yeah, it's one of the more disturbing things to do in Baghdad is to go to the local hospitals where Iraqi civilians are filling up the emergency wards with wounds, many of them from being caught in crossfire or perhaps being involved in some situation where American forces may have overreacted and may have opened fire at a checkpoint and there are innocent civilians who are wounded, and of course the U.S. administration has been very apologetic about these incidents, but they are happening and they are there. Also, there are a lot of wounded from a sense of a lack of law and order. I mean, there's a real attitude of wanting to even scores out there. And that is taking place on the street on every level, from families that may have a feud to some kind of tribal fighting that's erupted on the streets, to people who were really oppressed by Saddam's regime, maybe out actually killing ex-Baathists. We've seen at least 8 murders of former mukhabarat or security officers under Saddam's regime. So there's this sense of a real bloodbath in the streets and a lawlessness that is not only really tragic to see when you go to the hospitals, but it's not well documented. The U.S.-led coalition is not counting the deaths of Iraqis, not police nor civilians. And a lot of the human rights workers who I spoke with in Iraq are concerned about that. They feel that if the United States is going to be an occupying power, that they should be taking the responsibility to, at a minimum, keep an accounting of the extent to which civilian Iraqis and Iraqis who are serving in the police or other protective forces, to what extent they're being killed and injured as well, not just the American troops or the coalition troops.
Charles, you're researching now a magazine piece on empire, the history of empire in Iraq, focusing on the history of the British Empire in Iraq in the first half of the 20th century. Is there a scene, I know you spent a lot of time in Iraq researching that piece, is there a scene that stands out in your mind of something that you witnessed or learned that has a parallel to what the U.S. and the United States is facing now in Iraq?
One of the most interesting scenes I had in Iraq was actually going to a course at one of the great and famous universities in Baghdad, where the students were learning their lessons about the British occupation during and after World War I in Iraq. And I got to go to this university several times when I was in Iraq before the war, many, many years ago, and I was always frustrated that I could never get to really talk to the students because so many of the university professors were Baathists. One of the things Saddam had done is really keep a tight hold on the universities, almost like thought police that could keep the students understanding the Baathist message that Saddam wanted delivered. And anyone who would try to question that or anyone who would try to undermine that would really put themselves at great risk, and they could easily be imprisoned. So I very rarely was able to have a candid conversation with any Iraqi student on this university. So when I got to go back and meet with a lot of the, interestingly, some of the same university professors, there was this new sense of openness. They could finally talk, and that was really thrilling. But when I went to this one university professor who was teaching the modern history of Iraq, specifically the British occupation, he was an ex-Baathist who had not somehow been rooted out in the purge of the Baathist professors that had happened. And he basically began to give me a real Baathist rant. And I was surprised to hear it. But he invited me to go to his university class and to listen to his lecture, which I did. And I sat in the back with my translator, who gave me simultaneous translation. And we heard him try to teach this very heavy-handed history of British occupation and to keep making the comparison that the British made promises that were broken. And didn't America do the same thing when they arrived? And he just hammering this message about how the British occupation was no different than the American occupation. The proud Iraqi history was to throw the British out of this country. We'll do the same thing with the Americans. But what fascinated me was the students didn't want to talk about that. And they kept challenging this man about his past. And one of the most really thrilling moments I heard was when this professor said, history has sides. And during history, you have to choose sides. And his message obviously was, you should choose the side that's fighting against the American occupation, because everyone remembers those who sided with the British and didn't fight the occupation. but there was a student who stood up and turned it around and said, you know, you're right, history has sides, and you chose the side of Saddam Hussein. And the class just erupted into chaos, and everyone started yelling. The professor lost control of the students, and they were essentially confronting their past, a much more immediate past than the history lesson was about. But it was a really revealing and wonderful moment to see the students essentially confront this. And the class broke down. I mean, it fell apart. The professor essentially had to leave. And some of the students stayed afterwards and wanted to talk to me. And I thought what they had to say after the class was an even more important truth than what they were saying during the class and challenging this Ba'athist professor.
What did they have to say?
Well, it was a lot of different perspectives. A lot of them felt that they were glad that I was there, that I could see that. And to some extent, I wondered if they were not playing this up for me, which is always a concern you have as a journalist. You become, I guess, participant observer in some level. But I think there was a core of truth to that, which was that they wanted to directly confront Saddam's regime and express their loathing for it and how it was embodied in this professor. But there was something else that they wanted me to understand, which is that they did not like American occupation. They really wanted me to understand that, yes, this professor is right, that the British came here for oil and America came here for oil, that the British came with promises and America came with promises, that the British broke those promises and the Americans are on their way to breaking those promises, that the British occupation stayed too long, and that the American occupation is staying too long. But then they basically kind of reveal what I think is the most complicated reality of Iraq, and it is really the essence of everything I heard on the street, which is, yes, they want this occupation out, but not quite yet. And essentially you have a sense that the clock is ticking, that there is this hourglass on the American occupation, and that these students are watching that sand come down very closely, and they want it to end very soon.
Before our time runs out, I want to ask you, now that you're back in London, what it's like to be there now as London prepares for the meeting between President Bush and Prime Minister Blair on Thursday. It sounds, from reports we're getting here in the States, it sounds like there's an incredible security presence now in London.
It is a very stepped-up security presence for London, but, you know, coming from New York, it seems almost quaint. You know, 14,000 police, and they have 2,000 of them who have guns. And you kind of, as an American, you kind of think there's something quaint about this. It is a huge security presence for the British public, but I think Americans would not be that surprised. It would feel like any normal presidential visit to any city in America. Except here, it's a culture that's not used to this kind of fortress mentality. And it's really interesting to watch the British react to that and to try to understand just what will Bush's welcoming be here. There are a lot of questions about how he'll be received.
What's it been like for you to go back and forth between covering the war and its aftermath in Iraq and then, you know, covering London and in part covering the Blair government and seeing how they're responding to what's happening in Iraq?
It's been an interesting vantage point, really, to view the Transatlantic Alliance throughout the war in Iraq, both before the war when I was going to the demonstrations where 1 million people came out in the streets in London, the largest demonstration ever in the history of the country to protest this war and to really, I think, to protest Bush. I think there's a real personal level at which they oppose this man, and that's often misinterpreted as anti-Americanism. I think it's really directed on a very personal level against Bush. It's also been interesting to watch the British public and the British Parliament really want to see a deep probing of what some would call lies, what you'd have to call exaggerations of intelligence that were used to get this country to go to war. I think the British public really feel like they were sold this war through exaggerations and through half-truths and through lies. And a lot of the inquiries and investigations that have come out about that in the British public have been so much more vital, so much more productive, I think it would be fair to say, than those in Washington, which seem to be there. And there are some kind of procedural investigations that are going on, but it doesn't seem to have the traction. The criticism of the war doesn't seem to be strong enough, perhaps, in Washington to really push these inquiries to break open the story.
When you call those investigations, productive, what do you mean?
I think there's a dialogue here that people want to bring Blair to task for exaggerating the threat that Iraq had towards this country and towards the West and towards America. There's a sense that they want to say, look, you exaggerated this threat, and some would say you did so knowingly, and you should be brought to task for that because we feel this war was unjust and you tried to fabricate an immediacy of the threat that just isn't there. And so there's a sense of the British public really wants answers on this. They really want to review the history, and they want to look very closely at it. Now, we don't know exactly where the conclusions of these inquiries will come out, but it's widely expected that they'll be quite damaging to Blair. And I think that's what I mean by productive. I mean, there is a healthy examination of this war going on in this country that seems to have a different volume level than the examination that's gone on in Washington.
How are you preparing to cover President Bush's meeting with Tony Blair?
Well, I'm trying to understand how the British public feel about this guy, because there is this real split personality, I think, here. And I think it's very interesting, and I think it is kind of the core of understanding the visit. Because if you read the polls that are done by the European Union, kind of Europe-wide polls, they're very critical of Bush. There was one that came out last week that looked at which world leaders pose the greatest threat to world peace. And in this poll, the 7,000 people in Europe who were interviewed felt that George Bush was tied with Kim Jong-il as number two in posing a threat to world peace, which is pretty shrill anti-Americanism and pretty hard to fathom. Number one in that poll was the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. There was a poll that was produced by The Guardian, which is done by a polling agency here called ICM. The Guardian is a very liberal, left-leaning newspaper, and it actually came out with a surprising results of a poll that indicate a great support for Bush on his visit here. It found that 62% of voters believe that the U.S. is, quote, generally speaking, a force for good, not evil, in the world, and that only 15% of British voters agree with the idea that America is the, quote, evil empire in the world. It also found that a majority, 43%, say they welcome George Bush's arrival in Britain, and that only 36% would say they prefer he did not come. So I think, in a way, Bush's visit is going to bring out a very important debate, and one that I think is the real cutting edge of understanding how the world views Bush, because he's widely supported as the American leader here and welcomed, yet they want to say, we're really worried about the policies at hand and about the way you have conducted yourself as the leader of the American public, not only in the war in Iraq, but in terms of the steel tariffs that were imposed, Kyoto, Guantanamo. The list is long to try to expose, I think, the truths that the British public feel, that is, this is a unilateral presidency, and they're very worried about Bush personally. And that's not to be confused with anti-Americanism.
Well, Charles Sennett, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Charles Sennett is the London Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.